not only a plan for them individually, but also a life care plan for a child. Okay? So, just really got to think about this. That's all they think about. You know, where is Stephen going to be staying? How long is he going to be there? How do I support him? You know, that's a hard thing to answer, and these aren't easy questions by any means of the stretch. So, I mean, the next one. So, the first thing is how do you plan really for the future? What does that even look like? You know, what kind of medical treatments are going to be needed? But depending on what the diagnosis is, what kind of education are they going to have? Where are they going to go? What's their housing situation? These are all very complex questions that depend on the severity of the disability or the diagnosis. It can affect a lot of things. Are they going to go into a home? And is it going to cost extreme money? Or, you know, are they going to have to go somewhere that's, you know, a facility that's paid for by the state? You know, how very, very different treatments. I mean, you're not going to get the same treatment in both places. Does that make sense?
What is the most common disability that you see families planning around? Would it be Down syndrome, or would you say that it's another condition that I'm, again, just not thinking of?
You know, and I don't know what you're involved in, like how you see that, but I've seen an increase in diagnoses over the years, and I'm seeing more and more people being diagnosed, and it could be autism, and autism is obviously very high. We see that a lot, we see Down syndrome a lot. I would say the bigger thing is that we just see a lot more diagnoses from the doctors consistently that is impacting things a lot more. I mean, if you went back 15 years ago, I don't think the diagnosis was the same. It doesn't mean that the same amount of people were affected. Mm-hmm. I think the doctors being able to diagnose it properly and identify it was, they didn't have the capability. And that's just kind of our opinion on that, but we think that will continue to evolve, and I think it'll expand for a long time. You know, you talk about a firm, if you go think about some people that are really, really, really smart, there's a really high likelihood that they carry some sort of disability or some capacity because they have some sort of brilliance. That technically they probably would be somewhat diagnosed as having some sort of disability at some time. So it's just a matter of what scale does that have. So we see that all the time. I'll go back one more. Yeah, so creating a team. So you guys are all part of a team, or you serve people that are on that team? In the sense that we think every family should have a couple people surrounding them, and one of them is a financial professional that helps them make good steered decisions. You know, they need a good team of, they need an estate planning attorney that has a specialty in some capacity of special needs, or have the ability of understanding the difference, because there is a difference of planning there, and a specialty. Healthcare professional, they're dealing with health stuff all the time, so they need someone that can identify the right programs if they're not getting something through work. Guidance counselors, there's an entire team. But on the financial side, the other thing that's not on here actually is, you know, having a really good CPA that understands. So to kind of give you an idea of like the value of a CPA is, a lot of you probably look at me and say, hey, look like a pretty normal guy, but I have dyslexia and I have ADD. So I went to a specialized school in Dallas called Shelton. I don't know if anyone has ever heard of Shelton before or not.
Yep.
So I went there, and prayed all the way to graduation. Now, my mom's CPA, my dad's CPA, he had no indication to ever ask the question, do you have any children with special needs? Do you have any children that have any capacity? Even though I come across it just once again at that time. Didn't know so much anymore, but... as they paid for that private school, fifth grade to graduation, they could have written off every year. Their CPA never wrote off a year of tuition. Hundreds of thousands of dollars that could have been non-taxed. No, it's taxed. And I don't blame the CPA. I just use that example as a standpoint to show you, like, hey, it's really important to just identify and make them aware. If that CPA was aware, he probably would have been able to navigate a lot differently. He knows what he's doing. It's not that he's not able to
kind of documentation then would you have to have to be able to take that kind of write-off if you're putting someone in special schools?
So it has to be a specialized school for a certain disability from that perspective, and as long as they're qualified enough that I do be fine. We've actually got a couple pieces that we provide to CPAs to help steer them in the right direction of what can qualify and what can't qualify. Like another big one we see all the time is, if someone's going to build a house, are they going to make modifications to that house for their child? Well, those should be considered when they're filing their taxes. That's a modification above and beyond what a normal modification should be. And the CPA this year, they're going to build a house, right? Do I need to tax their old house or not? How long do they own it? They're not thinking the new house will also be anything. Make sense? So, or it might be a way they can navigate taxes too. And then they can say, hey, why don't we do some modifications to your house this year to get a higher income? Maybe we can do those modifications this year and help manage that. So, again, it's not that a CPA would miss it from that perspective. It's just we have to do our job as being part of these different families, providing this resource to the people that are on their teams and helping advise them in the right direction. Okay. Does that help answer the question? Government benefits. The government benefits we're not going to deal with, I can tell you. You can get SSI, SSDI, Medicaid. These are all Medicare. These are all things that you can provide as a benefit. Again, being affluent doesn't necessarily mean you won't qualify for those benefits. But you can, and it helps pay for these. Some of these families, they need just that little bit of extra support financially to be able to afford this. I mean, it's to take a child to therapies every day can really add up. You know, and sometimes health insurance can help, but a lot of times it doesn't cover everything that you need to cover on that side of it. So getting additional resources, there's a ton of resources out there. If you have a situation that comes up, feel free to ask. We have a lot of resources. Everybody in the community of people in the special needs world that have a specialty in it, it's a pretty tight niche community. And a lot of times if I don't know somebody, I know somebody they know very quickly. It's funny how that works, but there's a solve for everything. It's just a matter of finding the right people. And there's a lot of people that will provide money towards this, government support, and even private support from that perspective. So don't be scared to ask for help of resources. Say, yeah, I need this from that perspective. So last will and testament, this is extremely big, which was very true with me, obviously. But a lot of people focus on their estate without focusing on the side of their component, where that can really be backwards, because if you leave something to that child again and it goes over $2,000, you got problems. Right? There's tools that you can leave children money. There's ways to leave children money, you just have to do it in the right ways. You can have a special needs trust that helps get around things. You can have an ABLE account. Does anyone heard of an ABLE account? An ABLE account is a great tool to use. There's some drawbacks, there's some benefits to it, so you have to identify if it works or not. But as far as accessibility goes, you really need, this is a very key component to ultimately what happens. This is the communication from having a husband and wife transition and then no longer be there than you have been out there on that trial. Does that make sense? The way we kind of view on the estate planning side, the way we view on a planning component is, we believe that the family is really the special needs trust while they're alive. They serve as that component. They serve as the financial a lot of times. They serve as helping get that child from point A to point B, what doctors they see, what medical professionals do they need to see. But when they pass away, if they don't have the right documentation, that can go a very wrong way. And if the trust doesn't have the right language, that can be a massive problem. It can take all those government benefits away from that side. So any questions on that? I kind of don't do a special needs trust, but it does affect government benefits, and you have to know how to use it and not use it from that perspective. And that's why when we talk about a special needs trust, I do recommend that somebody utilize someone that has a specialty in this space. We were talking before this, but we have a lot of clients that are attorneys. that they are state planning attorneys and they can drive their own stuff because they've got a child with special needs. They don't feel comfortable trying to figure out the proper management to do all this. They don't want to ruin whatever it is that they're trying to accomplish. Make sense? So it's kind of one strategy or one conversation that I think could be helpful when we talk about special needs trusts is, do you have an ABLE account? Do you have a special needs trust? Well, what a lot of people don't know is a special needs trust typically can't pay for housing. That's a huge issue. One strategy around that is to utilize an ABLE account to pay for housing, allow the special needs trust to fund the ABLE account. So that would be an example of the utilization of tools, just so you guys kind of have an idea. But that's a huge risk component, I think, a lot of people don't really know what to do because housing is probably pretty important, especially if a child is going to send to, you know, a housing facility, maybe when you're gone or maybe now. That could be a big issue. And how do you pay for $5,000 a month? And again, where's that money? Make sense? And then reviewing beneficiaries. How many people have updated their beneficiaries in the last year? How many people don't feel like they do it very often? This is something that I think a lot of people just miss. Estate plan is great, all these things are great, but if you don't have the beneficiary set up correctly, what good are all these tools? The other thing is what are you going to leave in each of the tools? If you have a special needs trust and you've got a bunch of assets, maybe it makes sense to try to figure out what you should and shouldn't leave in a special needs trust. So here's a good example is it a good idea or a bad idea, you think, to leave an IRA into a special needs trust if you've got other assets you can leave? Maybe a Roth IRA. Might be better to leave a Roth IRA because you live the tax benefits. Where if you've got other children, you could hand those resources out to another child and you can kind of navigate this a little bit differently. Questions on that?
I would just add that, as you alluded to earlier, grandparents or other family members, it's good to have a conversation about this too with them,
yeah,
right? As you think about grandparents leaving assets to your children or yeah, you know, into trust that could impact them later, right? I think parents of special needs children need to ask around, is anybody planning to leave my children anything?
Yeah, there was a study about wealth, and they're saying that the wealthiest generation is happening right now, in the sense the biggest wealth transfer more wealth and transfers from one generation to the next than ever before. And it's a lot of wealth. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, the big thing is if you're doing planning for someone who maybe does have parents or grandparents, it's important to know if there's wealth there or not, because that can create a big problem coming down. And a lot of times we have to hold off on a little bit in the planning on the estate side to help incorporate grandparents in, because they may actually change a lot of things. Berkeley, you just don't want it to change all the time, so we might have to incorporate that in if it's important to have that conversation. And it's not just a financial thing either. It's the benefit side too. Who's going to care? Who's going to be the care provider for, you know, this parent or this child? Who's going to go take them to the doctor's office? Who's going to make sure they're getting the right care? Who's going to care? That's what I'm saying. Like, it's not as easy as just having, you know, one person that is not affiliated to go manage money. Listen, it's not that basic. Guardianship, conservatorship, very controversial subject in my opinion. A lot of people, the biggest thing with guardianship is, you know, what are the rights of a child when they turn 18? And there's some people that feel one way and there's some people that feel the other way. I think that every family needs to decide that on their own. But you've got to have someone who knows this space, an attorney that understands it. They have the relationships in the court systems to make this smoother. They know how to make this smooth. If someone tries to tackle this on their own, it's a mistake. It just is. You've got a great problem. So, but a lot of times it's a big controversial subject because at 18 years old, you're effectively deciding should a child have rights or not have rights. Or what are rights mean to them? Can they make their own financial decisions? You know, so for example, we have a client of ours that their son, he is a really good kid, but he's a very giving kid. And if someone comes up and asks him for his iPad, he's going to give him his iPad. Doesn't matter who it is, but he's just a giving kid. And for them, they don't feel comfortable with that kind of open ability. And so they took the financial side away from that. Does that make sense? So you, but every family is a little different. You've got to be in that. Identifying a care provider, it's really important that having the right people to care. And who's going to, effectively, a family member is going to be the mom or the dad is the care provider now, that who's actually making those decisions. And that's a hard decision to try to figure out who you have take over after you. And not only that, they know that they're doing it. Like, do they understand what it takes to take Timmy to and from every day? You know, wherever he's going. Or to brush his teeth without shirt. Whatever he has to do. And they know the impact on it. So, the letter of intent I talked about, it's really kind of the Bible behind the child of all the different moving parts, who they see, who's important to them, all the contact information. It's just documenting everything. What accounts are out there? Is there special needs trust? Is there contact there? All the different contacts that you could ever imagine from that perspective. So it is a really great resource. And then the last one, which you kind of referred to, is a family meeting. So with all of our clients, we actually have a family meeting with all the individuals that are involved. And the reason being is we want them to know what their responsibility is and we want them to accept it. Now, we have some families that they want to hold their own family meeting, and we coach our clients on how to have that family meeting in a proper manner. And then we've got a lot of clients that want us to actually help facilitate that family meeting, because they want to make sure everyone knows it's okay with working together. And then they're all at the table, and they all know who they're all if something was to happen. So, questions on that? So, again, typically we're talking to a bunch of families from that perspective. For you guys, I would tell you, where I would start is just identify, a lot of you probably, if you're working with individual clients or you're working with professionals that have other clients, I'm going to tell you they have somebody or you have somebody most likely in your book that is affected by special needs somewhere. And it's okay to ask the question. By not asking the question, you might be delaying them from benefits, you might be delaying them from service, and there might be a time it's just too late. You know, if they're gone tomorrow and a bunch of benefits, I mean, I'm going to go on with them, but I would assume if you guys are doing a lot of legal work, that you guys see a lot of money be moving and you're trying to fix the problem out of the back. Is that right?
Yep.
Is that more expensive or less expensive?
More expensive. Do it currently on the front end, it's going to cost you less money. If we have to go to court, and those courts can officially modify the estate plan of the deceased because they couldn't claim that their special needs to watch.
Now, if you don't do the planning beforehand, one component that I think is really important is it can be fixed, kind of. There's a difference between a first party and a third party special needs trust. And here's the thing is, if you do it after the fact, it's going to be in a type of special needs trust that potentially has clawback provisions for Medicare that can pull money back into the system. Where if you claim before, that's not a problem. And that's a huge issue. I mean, that could be a lot of money. I mean, that's. But if you just ask a bunch of questions before, it can be solved very immediately. So, I think the last slide is the last one. There's two things I want to bring up. I want to bring up your question about the $5,000. Then you had a question about life insurance incorporation of what was specifically your question?
My question?
All right, wait until you start meeting and I ask.
Well, I have a client who wants to give her daughter some money, but her daughter is on Social Security disability and Medicaid.
Okay.
And she wants to give her some money to be able to cover some of her expenses and so forth.
Yeah, so I would look at an ABLE account.
And ask the questions, when was the disability?
Yes.
So how old was the daughter when she became disabled? Because ABLE accounts are limited on age.
Yeah.
But if you go to Texas ABLE accounts and search it, there's a lot of great information, that an ABLE account is a wonderful way. you can give up to $16,000 a year in an ABLE right now.
Per person.
Per person into an ABLE, up to a maximum of $100,000 total. Can't go any higher than that. It does have a Medicaid clawback provision, so spend it. Don't let it sit there. But it's a great way. Another option that we consider a TrueLink credit card, because a TrueLink credit card is an alternative to guardianship and a way to give some financial money to someone, protecting benefits and letting them to pay things on their home.
And then in ABLE, we're not limited to Texas, we use Texas today. I'm not saying you don't, but there are ABLE accounts that have debit cards as well.
Texas has a debit card now.
Okay. So, I mean, there's really good benefits. I've got connections to Texas ABLE, and I'm sure you do too. We can happily connect you, and you can ask those questions so that's how I make sure it makes sense. The only hesitation I would have is that, like, our biggest weariness to ABLE accounts is that we are worried about people keeping a lot of money in them because of that clawback. We typically use them with a lot of our clients as a closed-loop account, meaning we're not going to hold a lot of cash in there for the purpose of. Now, there are times that we do because there's other reasons too. Like, if the child's 14, we need to shelter some of that cash again. But for the most part, you're going to want to just close through there. So if they're trying to spend it, that's the easy way to have it. Or she goes and buys something, a couple things for $5,000, and just pays for that. That's another way.
Okay. And if you do it within 30 days, it'll be okay. If mom gives her money today, and she spends it within the same month, so today was the first of the month, depending, mom gives her $5,000, daughter spends it all within that same month, she won't lose her benefit either because she received it and spent it in the same month.
Yeah, they take the average daily balance.
It is really good.
It's good. Does that kind of help with that question? And then the life insurance side of your question. So a big reason why life insurance that we utilize for a lot of our families is it's not always easy as a client's accumulating wealth and they just magically have all the wealth they need to have all their retirement book closings. So there's a lot of ways to fund a special needs trust, but an easy way to fund a special needs trust is using life insurance. They can own the policy, the policy can be beneficiary, the beneficiary can be the special needs trust, and that can create a leverage or benefit. And it could be at a very cheap cost, but it's a term. Ideally, we'd like to see more of like a permanent solution there because it's going to be there. But that's a very common solve because it's easy for people to be able to budget that in. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So, but it's a great tool.
Do you know anything about what the company called Lady Bird Trust, your residences for Medicaid parents, maybe they've been on Medicaid a long time, and the only asset they've got is their home, and they won't keep the government from confiscating the money from that to repay the Medicaid that they've got, so they create a Lady Bird Trust to put the home in.
Yeah, you can actually, I believe you can use a correlation of Lady Bird Trust and Special Needs Trust.
You can, but directly I'm going to your question, so I'm about to jump in. It's actually a Lady Bird deed,
yeah.
And it's a deed where I give the present interest of my home to my child, and that my child, I retain the right to live in with a life estate, and I can sell it, mortgage it, do whatever, but my children step in the moment they have a present interest in it, so for purposes of Medicaid, I no longer own it, and so when I die, it's outside of my estate, and does not be subject to MERC, which is the Medicaid Estate Recovery Program. And it may not always be the best tool to do it because there's other ways to handle avoiding that provision when it's just a house.
Yeah, because especially if you have like a dependent or child special needs, it's you can go to anywhere. How's that pan out in that situation? You know, they still have to take care of their house with a lot of things.
Well, if you were to deed your home to a special needs individual, they would then have a net worth in excess of their Medicaid qualification for most purposes, wouldn't they?
would not be accountable resource.
Right. It would not be accountable.
It would not be accountable resource.
Okay.
You can have like a car, you can have
okay.
a house.
All right.
But the later issue is, okay, if that child owned it and they were to sell it sometime in the future, well,
right.
that asset's already...
It'd be an absolutely illiquid asset yeah, to them, but then you have maintenance and all sorts of other things. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of... I've heard a lot of presentations from a lot of estate planning attorneys that specialize in this space that, that talk about the ownership of a house through the special needs trust.
Mm-hmm.
There's some different back and forth that they go on it, but... I tend to believe that it makes a lot of sense to keep assets inside of the special needs trust when you keep the control there.
Right.
But you also have to be careful. Like, we have a client of ours, and this is an unfortunate experience we've had to go through, but in unraveling of some estate plan, this is an example of an estate plan attorney that kind of, there was a special needs trust that was created, there was advisement from the special needs trust attorney and the CPA to move over oil interest inside of the special needs trust, and that's active now. And that oil interest was generating about $100,000 of interest every year in income, which is a massive problem. Because you're generating, immediately you're generating an income to a special needs trust at a higher tax rate, and they're not like, well, we just want to get the asset out of our control of us so that we get out of our state at a lower cost basis. Where we've had to unravel this problem, and it's been very difficult to do. But you can.
So, what was the solution?
Yeah, what was the solution?
Well, we're still in the process of identifying the best way to do it. Right now, the solution is to purchase it back out of the estate or out of the special needs trust.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually a lot of reasons to purchase it out. One, the best interest of the child because it doesn't generate the income stream anymore. But two, as an oil interest, that's extremely aggressive. And the flow in income has gone up and down very dramatically. So it's a heavy risk asset for a special needs trust, which special needs trust really shouldn't have full risk. I mean, it should not have as much risk as, you know, as that type of interest. So we're in the process of purchasing it out of the special needs trust. The question becomes, can we get it out of the special needs trust because the parents needed it in? Can they get it back out without having to basically create a taxable event for the child? Because there's a couple of names there. So we're looking at a couple of different strategies to navigate that problem.
So definitely want to keep oil interests out.
Yeah, I would look at every asset you put in the special needs trust. And I mean, now it doesn't mean that an oil interest doesn't end up in a special needs trust. I mean, if the parents are gone and there's no other dependents to receive an inheritance of any kind, then maybe that doesn't be special needs first. But while you're alive, probably not. I mean, you're going to get your tax return. Trust tax return is way higher than anything else.
And you're missing out on step up in basis, whereas if we had funded that special needs trust right now with something else to make it funded, they can leave that outside, let them die, then pass it to the special needs trust, make it special needs, get the step up in basis, and then the modest capital gains.
Yeah, a lot of times, like if you talk about life insurance, you can technically use that income to purchase life insurance and create a liquidity event, which is way better for special needs trust anyways. Mm-hmm. Not have an asset just spend cash. I mean, how are they going to get rid of this asset? They could sell the asset, but for pennies on the dollar compared to money. It's a hard asset to sell from that perspective. So that they could have done that in their deal, which is actually what they ended up doing in this scenario. Is they wanted to just remove that, they valued it what they felt was a fair value, and then they purchased a policy that they wanted to buy, and that's what's going to go into the policy and the professional insurance instead. And that's what they wanted. So.
Was that a term policy or a
permanent policy that they wanted?
Both their lives and second die.
Question. You have some people that like second dies. I personally don't love them. There's a place for them for sure. And I don't want to say that there's not a place for second dies. So this is purely an opinion from a planning perspective. We have clients that buy second dies all the time. But when you talk about special needs trust, you know, typically you have a husband and wife and they're both providing care. What I don't want to see happen is when one passes away, typically the other is going to try to provide some care. But if we still have to pay premiums on a policy and we don't have a liquidity event, I worry about the life that that policy is providing. Because if they can't pay that premium, what happens to the policy? And so I have a massive fear that I have, where even if one pass away, a liquidity event comes in, that flushes a lot of cash in and help. And that builds a peace of mind. Again, not that that's the solve for everybody, but I like that flexibility. I don't know if you feel the same way or not, but I think a lot of people sell second life policy. Any other questions on that? Anything else on special needs planning at all? I don't know how I'm doing on time at all.
You are great on time. Switching around here this way. Thank you. What a fantastic topic. I think lots of questions. Still more to come. I don't know about you guys, but if you can't see that number there, text that number, and let's get copies of this out to everybody.
I can send them to you.
Perfect.
And you guys can.
We'll also have the recording on our website, so if you wanted to go back and see any of this, or you wanted to capture that phone number again, or just have a colleague or friend listen to it, we'll have it posted on the FSP website in the next few weeks. So. Thank you, Curtis. Thank you for the phenomenal presentation. I hope everybody enjoyed your lunch today. I do have a speaker gift. Here it is. My apologies. So, speaker gift to you, sir. Yes, well, Cody has his own. This one's yours. Yes. Thank you for being with us today. Again, everybody enjoy the rest of your lunch. Thank you for your time today.